Second tape, March 31st, 1980, talking to Al Wright at his home in Kona. Okay, so you were just talking about one of the disadvantages, and that being trying to keep a business going.
I was saying, you know, that we leave here and then let's get somebody to take care of the business, and then it's so complicated and there's so many problems in the airplane business that, you know, everything would go to pot while we were gone, and then we'd have to come back and then try to reorganize it and straighten it out, and it just didn't work out. So we sold it last year. Bad enough running one flying outfit, let alone two. But see, now I have a partner in Fairbanks that takes care of it in the winter. In fact, he practically runs the whole business now. And so that's the only reason we can do it, come over here. Because otherwise, you couldn't leave a business that long.
Who's your partner?
Bob Bursley. He's a young fellow that flew for me he's been with me now, I think, about 10 years. And, I was trying to, you know, figure out a way to get out of the, you know, being so tied down in the flying business. And at the time I started this Wright Air Service, I had 3 kids flying for me. So I incorporated the outfit and gave Meech a share in it, you know, quarter share in it, so we're all equal. And then the corporation was buying me out, see. Well, the other two, they finally fizzled out of it, but Bob stuck with it. And he owns half of the air service now, and he runs it. And so I, you know, go up and help him out in the summer, but I don't have to be, you know, tied down to it 12 months of the year like I was. And generally he takes a vacation before I leave up there, so I'm there while he's gone. And he doesn't stay very long, 2 or 3 weeks, and then he's back. But he's young and eager, see? And I'm getting old and decrepit. My vacation takes 4 months.
How old is he?
I think he's about 30 now.
So when you go back there now, you said you're gonna be doing some work with the air service.
Yeah, we gotta, you know, get ready for the summer operation and get all the airplanes. So we have mechanics working, but there's always a lot to get, you know, going for spring. And see, I have the way I operate up there. I work in the air service, but I have I run this fish camp down there in the Minto Flats, you know, where I take in people for pike fishing, you know, sports fishing. And then, of course, I have the salmon fishing outfit on the Yukon that I take care of, too. So I have to get, you know, everything ready for that. I get all the nets mended and fixed up for the Yukon. And then, see, when we get back, then Jeannie and I will go down to the Minto camp and fix it up and get it ready for the season, which starts about June, you know. And so we go down and stay for a couple of weeks in the spring and fix all the boats and motors and patch up the camp, you know, and get it ready to go. Then we go, when we get our operation ready to go over to the Yukon, we move over there about the 1st of July. And Jeannie stays over there. And my boy, Jack, he stays over there too fishing. And then I just run back and forth and haul the fish in from the Yukon and haul the people into the Minto camp back and forth. And so I'm just flying all around. Plus I make, you know, if there's any other, all the pilots are busy, then I make a few charters, you know, to fill in when they're, all the rest of the pilots are busy and they need other trips to make. So I just kind of, you know, fill in all the way around now and try to, you know, keep everything organized.
Mm-hmm. So the camp in Minto, pipe fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So you drop people in there and then you camp out?
Well, yeah, see, no, it's just the, we have a package deal, you know, that we take and take, we furnish people the transportation in and out and a cabin and there's on a boat and a motor, and they bring their own groceries and fishing gear, and we furnish everything else. See, we have, you know, cooking gear and everything in the cabin ready to move in, and so we just rent them the, we sell them the package, they stay, take them down one morning, they stay overnight and bring them back the next night, gives them 2 days of fishing. And that's the way most of them go, and sometimes people want to stay longer, they just pay for extra days. And so, see, I take a bunch in and then try to arrange it. So I took somebody in when I brought them out, but most times it doesn't work. You have to make a trip in and out for the same people, and then the same time next time. And then we use that camp for duck hunting in the fall when the duck season opens, hauling duck hunters in and out of them.
So how many people do you usually get to come out pike fishing or to go duck hunting?
Well, in that camp, we can take care of about maximum about 12 people in the camp. And so July and August and September, there's probably the camp's got, I'd say, an average of about 8 people every weekend in there. And then maybe an average of about 4 people during the week. And so, yeah, something like that. People in and out of there.
That's for both fishing and
hunting, yeah.
Wow, that's a good number for you.
Yeah. And then see, it works out good for the air service because it's a short trip. And we can always work them in amongst other trips, you know. It only takes about, counting the ground time and everything, you're taking an hour to go down there and back, you know. So, and then I have to go and fix the motors, which is the biggest problem in the camp, is keeping the darn motors running, because you even put new motors in and some of these people will screw them up. But I have to go one day a week and fix all the things that are broke on the motors.
So who are the people that usually go in there, and how would they find out about you?
Well, most of them are just local people around Fairbanks. And the people have been in there before, and they just keep going back. They like the, you know, the area and the facilities, and it's, you know, a reasonable trip. And then we get quite a few tourists come through too. And it's mainly we don't do much advertising. It's just mainly word of mouth that gets around. We take them out. And we don't try to make a big deal out of it because the place won't stand very much pressure. It's actually getting too much fishing pressure right now from, you know, there's so many airplanes around Fairbanks now, and it's close, so they're all going in there fishing. Plus there's 2 or 3 other guides that take fishing parties in there, and it's getting overfished really right now. So, but we just, you know, take in a few. We don't try to push it. You know, take too many. Just keep a few people there to keep the camp intact, you know.
So, is that a cabin that you built that's there?
Yeah, I have 3 cabins there that I built.
How long has that camp been there?
That camp's been there for as long as I know. The Minto people used to camp there in the spring. When they gathered up from around the flats, it's right in the point where you come out of the big Minto Lake and Gold Stream come together, and it's just above the Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody that came out of the flats in the spring in their canoes would all gather there. They had a bunch of, they call it the caches. There's a bunch of old caches right across from my camp there. Most of them are tumbling down now, but in the early days, each family had one of these caches. And they'd, you know, store their stuff in it when they'd leave the flats and go back to the river. Anything they didn't want to take or didn't need, they'd put in these caches, and then they'd be there when they came back, you know, the next year. And nobody ever bothered anything. But there used to be a lot of, you know, old antique things in those caches, but everything's stripped out of them now. They're, you know, everybody's gone in there and packed the stuff off. And, well, you know, nothing that's of value. It's just stuff that people used to use and had a use for, but they never used anymore. And there was all stuff in there till probably around 1950 in some of those caches. But now, by then, it was all cleaned out. And see, they, after you got the motorboats and, you know, and airplanes around, then they didn't use those much anymore, those caches. Because I used to fly people in there, and see, they always fished for pike there in the fall. Right after freeze up, they'd cut a hole in the ice and catch pike like they were going out of style, you know, stack them up and by cordwood, freeze them, and then haul them into the village, see, my dog team. And then after I started flying there, then I used to fly them in, and I'd haul tons of them in there from that place. And they used to have a big weir there years and years ago across that creek, see. And then the fish would all come down there and couldn't get by, and they'd be just ganged up there, and they'd just dip them out with a dip net or however they got them out. And then when they got what they needed, they'd open it up and let them go. But of course, that's all illegal now to do that. So now the people from Minto come up there. They always, there's still probably four or five families that come up there in the spring, and they set nets around there for pike and whitefish and hunt muskrats and stuff. But there ain't too many of them that do it anymore up there. That's always running. Peter John always comes up there. Matthew Titus and Dorothy Titus. And, well, we'll see. There's Susie Jimmy comes up there. Ike Edwin. Oh. Jim Alexander, Evelyn always come up there. Some of those older people still come up there and camp. But, you know, they had a real tough time for a while there because there was a batch of radical kids there that had come in and just break into everybody's cabin around that area and just wipe them out, you know. And they wiped me out a couple of times. But the last year or so, they've been getting a little better. For a while, they just, and they tear everything up, you know, they take these duck camps around that big lake and just destroy them, you know, and burn them down, everything else. But the cops had come down and catch them and take them to Fairbanks, and they'd take them to court and turn them loose, and they'd go right back at it again. They wouldn't do nothing. Well, on the big lake, there's quite a few people out of Fairbanks that have duck hunting cabins down there. And see, that lake now is all state land. The Minto village tried to get it, but they couldn't. You know, they were allowed just so much land. They had to take it around the village. And it's out of the village area. So there's a lot of them got, you know, these homesteads in there, the native land claims, you know, homestead. And that's how I got the one I got there, with this native land claims deal. And they have areas around there, but the rest of those, there's probably about a dozen cabins around that lake, the big lake, that are owned by people in Fairbanks, mostly businessmen, use them for just for duck hunting in the fall. But there used to be in the old days a camping grounds along there, and just above where I'm at there's a old Indian graveyard, what they call the graveyard camp. And that's the place, you know, I was telling you back there where I went with my dad, my dog team, that was the place we went to, one of them that I remember. And there was other places like lake they call Four Cabins, that's where my grandmother used to live. And they call it that, you can't see any cabins there anymore, but I guess there used to be four cabins in there, right close to the Chattanooga, and right down from it, just a little ways, there was a big hole that was really good for pike fishing in the fall. And still is. You go in there and it's a big deep hole right after freeze up, and you can cut a hole in the ice and just drag out all kinds of them. But there was, you know, there's little spots like that around where these people used to, you know, get out most of their fish in the certain times of the year. But
that Mentor Pass is really a rich area.
Yeah, it was. It still is. Yeah. There used to be a lot of moose in there, but they really got chomped down, the population. But now they're coming back. There's getting to be some more down there. But it got hunted so heavy in the late 60s and early 70s, and between them and the hunting and the wolves, really took their toll. See, we had a big increase in wolves in that country in about, actually it goes way back to where in the 50s the government started poisoning wolves. There was so many of them that the slack game was just going down the tube all over the whole state. So they brought in they hired a bunch of crews and they dropped poison bait all over the country. Over the Alaska Range and the Brooks Range and all the valley, every place. They dropped it all over. And then they had, they first started doing this wolf hunting by air about that time. And they sent out, you know, teams and tried to kill thousands and thousands of wolves. And finally, the word got out. And of course, not only wolves, but they were killing bears and foxes and wolverine and everything else and get that bait thing. But that's probably what saved the game in Alaska anyway, you know, the game animals, because the rest of this stuff came back pretty fast. But then the game started building up again, you know, real good. And until about the late 60s, you know, we had a peak population of game. And there was a lot of it, you know, like you could go get a moose anytime you wanted it. And then they took the bounty off the wolves and started protecting them. And then the game population just plummeted. They had some bad weather conditions, was due to a lot of it. And heavy hunting pressures in certain areas. But in other areas where there was no hunting, the game went too, completely went. But the country was just flat overrun with wolves again. If they left it on and controlled it, you know, we'd have been all right, but they didn't. So it all went to pot. And now they're trying to, you know, they started in on just little pilot projects of controlling the wolves, and the game's coming back in those areas. But if they just, you know, kept control of the thing right from the start, well, we'd still been in good shape for game. Because, you know, I was hunting wolves in the 50s, and they took, in 1 month, over 3,000 wolves north of the Brooks Range by airplane. And it just, you know, hardly dented the wolf population. And
how about around the Mentor Pass?
Yeah, there was a lot in there. There was a bunch moved in. Let's see, I was trying to think what year it was. Around 1970, there was a big bunch of wolves moved into the flats, and I killed about 10 or 15 of them. But I watched one bunch. They were along the Chattanooga River, you know, and I was always preaching, you know, trying to control the wolves. And of course, all the pressure the fish and game was getting from the environmentalists and everybody, you know, they couldn't kill them anymore. But I did, you know, an awful lot of flying for the fish and game, you know, surveys, all kinds of surveys, you know, from counting fish to wolves and moose, caribou, everything. And but I ran this little project on my own. I was going into Minto quite a bit. So once a week I'd go across to the Chattanooga River, and there was from the where the bridge crosses on the Steese Highway to the Minto Flats. I went one day and I really counted good, and I found 12 moose in that area. It's only about 10 miles long. And so I knew these wolves were working on that river, so I watched them. And about once a week, one more of them moose, the wolves would get. At the end of I started that in November, and in January, the end of January, there wasn't one of them moose left. They got every one of them. And there was eight wolves. There was eight wolves in that pack. And they were really smart. I got a shot at them just once. I killed one of them. But, you know, they knew there was still hunting going on then. And they hear an airplane, they head for cover right now, you know. And so you just flat can't get them. They're hard to get. Got to get them in the open. But if they just taken control of that stuff, they want to control one side and not the other side. If they controlled everything even, they could, you know, I know they could sustain a nice, even flow of animals all the time. And it's good for everybody, you know, everybody can use that, all the game animals. They can't eat a wolf, you know, or a bear, and the bears kill off so many moose and caribou you wouldn't believe. It, you know, the fish and game are just starting to see that, and I've been preaching that to them for years, because I watched them. You know, I lived in the woods so long, and flew over so much of the country that, you know, I could see what was going on. But to try to convince somebody of that is impossible. You can tell them, but they won't believe. You got to show them, so they'll believe, and it's hard to do that. You know, you see one of these instances maybe once in a year, if you're lucky, you know, one of these drastic things where you can really see the exactly what's happening. Because most of the stuff that's going on is at night, or, you know, someplace where you're not around. How these, you know, wolves operate and the bears and stuff. But I've seen bears, you know, kill a moose, and they kill them so easy. That's one of the things that declined the caribou herds real bad, I think, too, was the bears. Because they get in the calving area, and they just, you know, kill those calves when they're born, like they're going out of style. They just grab them and kill them and eat them if they felt like it, and they wouldn't if they didn't. And also the wolves, they get in there, and the wolf pups practice on them. You know, they just kill the calves because they can get them easy, and they don't eat them. Eat what they want. In this business, they say you only kill the sick and the wounded. Is flat baloney all the way down the line, because a wolf, you won't kill a sick caribou and eat him. You'll go get the biggest, fattest one you can find, just like a man will. If he's got nothing else, if he can't find nothing else, sure, he'll take him. But he's going to take the best one he can find first. And, you know, I've seen a lot of that.
Well, as far as hunting goes, what do you think about this thing that happened a couple of years ago with was it Richard Frank? I forget the guy's name. Something Frank in Minto who shot a moose.
Oh, that was Carlos Frank.
Carlos Frank.
Yeah, he shot a cow moose for a potlatch.
Right. What do you think about that whole thing?
Well, I think it was stupid of him to arrest him for that, but because them people have been doing that for, you know, ever since they started. Of course, they make the law. I guess you're supposed to live by it, but You know, if they have a potlatch or something, I don't care how many laws they make, they ain't gonna stop them from going and getting a moose for their potlatch. You know, it's all these laws are made for a purpose. I'll grant you, but when you change somebody's way of life or something that they believe in, you know, for the law, they ain't gonna stop them from doing something. And actually, you know, they use all that meat. They don't. They were just killing it for the hell of it. Like all these people that were going along the highway and shoot a moose and leave him lay there. I can see they ought to really get tough with them. But for somebody that's really utilizing it, those natives, I don't think they should. You know, it's hard to do though. You know, it's hard to overlook it for one person and not for another. They got to have, and if they're living like white men, I guess they got to live by their rules. But it's hard to do. I live by my rules too, you know. Not only what the government tells me to do.
I think it's really interesting earlier about how some people say that maybe people should just kill everything, and you're talking about how they would manage the country.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, for example, you know, where they had the big deal was on the caribou that they killed over there on the, around Kotzebue area. And they went out with snow machines and killed a whole bunch. And then they went away. But, I don't know what the circumstances were on that, but, you know, like, I know for sure, I've been around Anituvik Pass a lot, and those people, you know, they live on caribou. And they went out, they go with snow machines and kill caribou, and they kill, you know, 20 or 30, whatever they need. And they take them home, and they have a big ice cellar they put them in. And it stays frozen year round, you know, all summer, because it's opened up in the winter and gets, you know, extremely cold, and then everything's frozen solid, permafrost, and they have a door trap door. They go down inside. Well, they store them all in there, and then they take them out as they need them through the summer to eat them. And they didn't really start that until they stayed in Anituvik, because they had to have a school and a church and all that stuff, and they couldn't be nomadic anymore because their kids had to go to school. Before that, they just moved around, and it's the same in the area of, you know, in the interior around Minto or any of those villages. They killed what they had to get. I know when I was a kid, we used to go, I went with my dad, and he'd kill 20 or 30 caribou at one time in the fall, and then we'd, you know, dress them out and pile them up and come back and haul them in as we could with a dog team, and we used them for to eat and for dog feed and everything, you know. And the reason he did that was because they'd only come through once in the fall and maybe once in the spring. You didn't kill as many in the spring, just what you needed right then, because you had other things, you know, like there's ducks coming back and fish and everything like that. But in the fall, you tried to get what you needed for the winter. And even the, you know, the trappers, like around Michumen and places, they do the same thing. They'd kill, you know, 40 or 50 caribou, and enough to feed them and their dogs through the winter, freeze them. But they never wasted it. And there was lots then, and they didn't deplete the herds. It wasn't from that kind of hunting that depleted the herds. It's other things, you know, like sickness or predators and stuff like that causes a decline. And you know, like this, I was saying this managing bit, like the native people, and if they had a trap line going, they only took as much as they needed. If they needed a certain kind of animal to, you know, sell for fur, like mink or beaver or anything like that, they took out, you know, what they needed, and when they got what they figured they needed, they quit trapping it. Or if they figured they wouldn't let a beaver house die, you know, they they take out maybe two big ones out of it and let the rest of them go to another house, see? So there's always a new crop coming up. Where like most of these white trappers, they tried to get everything, you know, clean it out. Because they were after the money. And in the old days, the native people were interested in was just making a living. That's all. They didn't care about getting rich. All they wanted was make a living.
Well,
so they just take what they needed, and they knew that if they left it, it was going to be there next year. So they didn't want to clean anything out, you know. And it was healthy for the population doing it that way, for the animal population, because they took out the older ones and the bigger animals, and the new ones could keep coming.
Well, what do you think the fur buyers or the guy running the trading post thought about that?
I don't know.
And here are these guys.
Well, they're getting the best fur, you know. But they got enough, you know, what they needed, but they didn't go break their neck every day to try to get one more skin. And then they and deplete the population.
Were there other white trappers going in there who just
There was a lot of them, but there was a lot of trappers, white trappers that lived all over that area that did the same thing the natives did. They took out, you know, just so much, and when they figured they had enough, that they'd quit, you know. But then there was other ones that would go in and into an area and just try to, you know, get everything they could right down to the last minute.
There's people like that right now.
Yeah. And especially now since the snow machine came, you know, they can go so far and cover so much territory that it's so much easier. See, like they used to just trap a small area, most of them. Some of them went a long way, like old Justin Frank, you know, Richard Frank's dad. He went all the way from Minto to the Yukon River trap line and back.
How many miles
is that? He had a trap line that was maybe the way he went, probably a couple hundred miles, you know, around there and back and forth. And he'd go out and be gone for a month at a time, you know, covering the line. There was a few of them, those old Indians that had long lines, but most of them, they just trapped one little area. And so they'd be home every night.
Just make a living.
Yeah. That's all, you know what? Most of the people, that's all they were interested in anyway, was making a living. Up till recently, you know.
I've always been interested too in the kind of, in how stereotypes get started to people. And it seems like this is a situation that I can just imagine a trader who gets a bunch of gear and everything together and sets somebody's winter outfit up, and they go out and trap, and they just come back and pay for their outfit, and the trader thinks he's going to make $1 million off the guy, you know.
Well,
he probably thinks he's lazy or something after that.
Well, he thinks everybody's lazy. But I'll tell you that the trader, everybody curses him and says what bad people they were and everything, but they weren't. You know, they made money. Yeah, they made a lot of money. But they also helped those people, too. You know, they'd taken take a family, go. They had a trader stay here, and there was 20 or 30 families living in a village. And so he's supplying them all the needs that they have, you know, for their livelihood, the food and their clothing and all this stuff, you know, that he brings in. And so they go to work and bring their fur in to him. And he takes it all and gives them a certain price for it, and they pay up their bill that they've charged there, you know, through the summer and through the fall into the winter till they get their fur. And they pay it all up, and they have a few extra dollars that they can spend on booze or whatever they want. And then they're broke again. And most all of them, you know, just spend what they had left on booze. So they had nothing. They paid up their last year's bill, and they had their drunk. And they're broke and they don't have nothing to eat. So the trader gives them food on credit again, see? Everything he needs to keep his family going for the year. Then the next year he pays them off, same thing. So he's, you know, seeing that the family made a living through the year, each one. And most of the time he'd take one guy and make an example of him. He'd say, okay, like a guy would say, oh, you're not paying me enough for my fur, so I'm going to the fur buyer down so-and-so and sell my fur. So he'd go do it, see, and he wouldn't pay his bill because he'd blow it all. So then the guy, trader, would say, okay, no more, I'm going to cut you off. And he'd cut him off, and he'd have such a tough time making a living that the rest of the people would see this. And, you know, then they'd say, well, geez, I ain't going to get in that position, so they wouldn't go sell their fur someplace else, you know, if they were dependent on that trader for a living. So, you know, all the kids would get something to eat through the year, regardless, you know, of what happened, because the trader would be carrying them. And, you know, a lot of them would really nick them good for their fur and make a lot of money on it. But it didn't make any difference if he didn't get it. You know, it was going to be blown on booze anyway. So why was he so bad? Huh? And it is a lot of people just think that old Dominic Vernetti down there used to be in Kaiakuk. He was probably one of the most successful traders on the river, and he took care of all those people, you know, quite a bunch from all over that area, all up and down the Kaiakuk. And that's the way he did it. And he had a liquor store there, and he'd ration the booze out. He'd have 1 hour that the liquor store would be open. They could buy booze. And then no matter what, how bad these guys wanted or how they tried, he wouldn't give them no more, you know, until a certain time. And he took all their money, but he took care of them all the time. They all made out, you know. And like there's one guy, I'll never forget this story, he was telling about this guy bought an engine when, you know, they first started getting boats up there, inboard engine. It was a little Red Wing or something, 12 horsepower inboard motor, you know. And he bought it from Dominic, and he says he's going to pay so much a year on it until it's paid off. And so he's paying, and the amount that the engine was worth should have been paid off in about, say, 3 or 4 years. Now he was paying on it. Well, after about 10 years, somebody asked him, geez, you ought to have your motor about paid off, huh? So he said, well, I don't know, it might be. So he went and talked to Dominic. He said, the guy told me I should have my motor paid off. Dominic says, yeah. He said, this was the last payment. He said, it's all yours now.
We heard a lot of stories about Dominic. He must have been quite a character.
Yeah.
You knew him?
Oh, yeah, real well. I used to fly out of there quite a bit. I had an operation based in Kaiakuk for about 3 or 4 years. And he was a banker and everything, you know. He'd pay all the charters for everybody. We'd take and fly those people all to their trap lines all over. And he'd pay the bills. And then, you know, collect it from them after they brought their fur in. And nobody could put anything over on him. I remember once we went into this camp, and it was in December, you know, before about the middle of the marten season. And he was going around gathering up skins, you know, taking a few things around, visiting the people. He used to do that once in a while. And he'd make sure he'd visit the people that really owed him a lot of money, you know. So this one tent we went in, and the guy brought his fur out and laid it all down. They haggled about the price for a while. And so Dominic bought the fur from him, and it was all second grade stuff, you know. So he looked around, he says, well, where's the rest of your fur? The guy said, that's all, there's no more. So he walked over someplace under the mattress and reached down, and he pulled out a whole string of first class prime marten. The guy just laughed, and he says, well, I tried anyway. So he graded them out and put them on the account, you know. So it was pretty hard to pull anything on him.
Yeah, he knew a lot of tricks. Yeah. He probably knew so many tricks he pulled on himself too.
Yeah. He always, his birthday was a big event down there. He'd have a big birthday party on his birthday. Everybody from all the villages had come. And he furnished everything. And of course, they'd put in other stuff, you know, like meat and fish and stuff. But all the women would get together and do all the cooking, see, and make this big, big potlatch every year. And we used to fly him in from, that was really the time to make money in those days. You'd go to one of those villages and fly the, pretty near the whole village up there, see. You know, about three or four different villages, all Nulato, Calpeg, Galena, Huslia, Alakakit. They'd come from all over. For Dominic's birthday was a big event. Huh?
When was his birthday?
I think it was towards spring. I think about in March, sometime around there. Well, it was, that was one of them. They had dog races, they had everything. Yeah, it was a...
How about other traders along the river? Like, there must have been like somebody in Tolavana.
There was a guy in Tolavana years ago named... what was his name? Martin. Somebody Martin was his name. And then when he left there, then there's another guy that was a school teacher in Minto moved in there named Sinclair. And but it was, the thing was gone, but there was nobody living there. Only two or three people living there then. And he just kind of lived there. And then he sold it to another school teacher from Minto. No, Sinclair was the last guy that was there. There's another one before him. But there used to be about, probably six or eight families lived there in Tolavana. And then, see, it was a good trading post because it was on the mouth of the Tolavana River. And the people coming down the Tolavana stopped there. And then the people coming out of the Cantishan area would come in there. And so it was a good spot for a while until the airplane started coming. And then it died because everybody go then into Nenana or Fairbanks because they could get better price for their fur. And they, and there was a guy in Minto named Johnny Campbell that had a store there. And he did pretty good, but he had his problems too. I mean the credit, you know. But you know, just about every village had a trader all along the way. And they all operated basically the same way, except some of them were a lot shrewder than others. But Dominic was probably the top trader in the whole interior.
How are you doing, buddy?